Were any of your formative crushes cartoon characters? Are any of your current crushes cartoon characters? If so, you are far from alone, as my Pinterest homepage will attest. I'm comedy writer and 42-year-old child Gabby Hutchison Crouch, and my interest in cartoon characters has made Pinterest an algorithmic nightmare to scroll in public. What's their appeal? Let's find out with the help of some funny guests who are here to talk about the animated characters that have starred in the very private fan art of their minds. Will we find something out about early crushes, pop culture and sexuality, or will we just go on about the ideal frame rate for perfect boob wobble? Whatever we do, I hope it'll help you feel that your Pinterest page, being just image after image of Benger off Dungeons & Dragons lifting his robe up, is absolutely fine. Welcome to Curiously Drawn. With me this episode is a comedian, writer and audio presenter, as heard on XFM and James Acaster's Findings. He and I spent lockdown doing a Tuesday night Zoom quiz that was supposed to be about comedy, but very slowly became almost entirely based around the Dibley Parish Council seating plan. It's Nat Metcalf.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Is it Metcalf? I pronounced it in a very northern way. That's Metcalf, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'd say Metcalf, but
Metcalf.
Like, my family are northern,
oh,
so I
right,
guess it
yeah,
could be
I
Metcalf.
My vowel went up the M1 there. It does happen sometimes. Metcalf.
I've been in London since I was three, but I like that people from London will never accept me as one.
Oh,
it's like, no, it's not proper London though.
Yeah,
born,
we're born within bells.
Yeah,
it
doesn't count.
You don't know a cray. Where were you born then?
I was born in Carlisle in Cumbria.
Oh, okay, so you are northern technically.
Yeah, I know. Not that you can tell. Although I think I've got a strange voice, and some words go a bit funny every now and then.
Mm.
But in general, I think people think I've got this sort of strange South London voice, like all the members of Squeeze had babies. I've got this voice. It's not even
a squeeze voice.
A squeeze voice. Yeah, I've got a very squeezy voice. And because I don't really think this is a London accent, I feel like I've developed it from. I mean, I suppose this is what all accents are, but I feel I've picked up whatever accent I have by trying to imitate people around me. And I've
described
what I'm essentially doing
accent.
Is an impression. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm constantly doing an impression just to fit in. But I guess that is what accents, or they all are, aren't they?
That is what an accent is. It's everyone who, it's really weird when I do talk to somebody from Ilkeston, where I grew up, like my vowels go, it's ridiculous. They, as I say, it shoots right up the M1. It's a phenomenal speed. And yeah, my vowels just quickly, they turn on a dime just because my brain just, yeah, my brain goes, oh, no, this is the accent we're speaking in now. It's really funny.
Oh, no, I think I do that. I do it. And sometimes I go more, a bit more Cockney or I sort of tone it down. And I can hear myself doing it and I kind of hate myself for it.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? And I think it's because I don't really know how I talk. I think it's that thing where, like, it's like when you think about breathing and you're suddenly very aware of it. It's like, what voice am I doing now? I've got no idea how I sound.
Well, let's move on and talk about cartoons, which is why we're here. We'll talk about your getting with your first choice. So your first choice is a classic likable antagonist: rude, aggressive, impossible to please, terrible at baseball, and even worse to practice American football with. To her credit, she's possibly the cheapest psychiatrist in America, and she does appreciate classical music, or at least she pretends to, in order to impress a boy. She's tenacious, she's violent, she's the original Fussbudget. It's Lucy Van Pelt from Peanuts! Yay! I really like Lucy. I really, really like her. Just right from the start, she really does grab you in Peanuts as, like, a really... just sort of really interesting character, you know, because there's so many really passive characters in Peanuts.
Yeah, but I don't know, they are all interesting. And they've all got, they're really three-dimensional, aren't they?
They are, aren't they, ironically.
And I should point out, this was sort of, when I was a kid, I always felt like, this is the one, I think. Lucy is always the one that I really gravitate towards. Even though I think me, and probably lots of people reading it, is almost designed to be very Charlie Brown kids, but still still, Lucy is the one that's very kind of attractive in that kind of always doing stuff, but also kind of a bully, which again, yeah. I don't know what it says about me, but it's this sort of, she's sort of bossy, definitely a bully, and could be almost the sort of villain of it. But what I like about her is, and I think that's that sort of clever thing about it, she really does have the like Achilles heel in Schroeder, where yeah. she's different with him than everyone else. And he's got this like, almost kind of stuffy kind of aloofness. And you should kind of feel a bit like, well, she's a bully to everyone else, and sort of think that he's probably, well, that serves her right. But you go, oh, come on, Schroeder, just give her a bit of, give her something.
Yeah,
Laura
Bone.
Yeah, it's very much in the same way. I always think, like, when you watch cartoons, Roadrunner's the bad guy. He's the bad guy. I hate the idea that, like, people go, oh, well, it's like, it's about this guy trying to kill this nice Roadrunner. It's like, but it isn't. Roadrunner's the bad one. The guy who's, like, all your sympathy is with Wile E. Coyote in there.
Yes! I always root for him. He is a carnivore. It's not his fault. He is in the desert. He's just a hungry animal, and he needs to eat, and that's not his fault. No. Humanity is the real villain in that, because humanity always sends him dodgy products. Capitalism is the true enemy. Is the true antagonist of the Roadrunner cartoons.
He's a trier.
He doesn't give up.
He should persevere with the same plan a bit differently, I always think. Let's do the same plan again a little bit differently, and you nailed it. But he always starts again, which I think is his problem. But it's sort of admirable how hard he tries and how willing he is to start again and just keep going.
I love a trier, and I love a tenacious character, and I think that's a lot of what I like about Lucy. Yes. Because she is tenacious, and I really like that, you know, especially in a female character, you know, because this is, you know, Peanuts originates in like 1950s Americana. It's coming from like the post-war baby boomer Americana. They are very much in sort of the suburbs, aren't they? They're not urban kids. It's like very much the sort of the suburbs, the nuclear families, and sort of being sort of out in the open and playing baseball and going to the woods and stuff. And that, you know, we've been sort of sold this idea of 1950s, 60s Americana, that's very, the gender politics is very sort of regressive, that girls were supposed to be like pretty and passive and just want to be housewives and mothers, and that boys were supposed to be all rootin' tootin' shooting and smoking and but it's you know, this is the reality of that life, as certainly as Charles Schulz saw it, and it obviously appealed to Americans of his time enough for it to be a huge hit as this sort of slice of life observational comic strip about childhood in the 50s. That it's not that, it's not like the sort of the patriarchal story that we've been sold, and it's so great to see, especially to see a girl be so active and to the point of being unpleasant.
Yeah,
it's really good to see an unpleasant girl in the 50s.
I think it's realistic. I think it's that what we're used to, as we're from gender, that always looks back to the 50s, whereas this is contemporary, and it's sort of saying this is what life is like, and it never really changes. It's only through looking back we kind of assemble these little things and decide what the 50s is, like Happy Days. But it's like
Happy Days in Greece were made in the 70s,
and I think it always feels like it's of its time and all the time. And I think when you would have all those kind of in the 70s, lots of the idea of people going to psychotherapy and things, where you have Lucy's psychiatrist stalwart she's got. And also the way that Charlie Brown speaks in this way that feels like he's sort of voicing all his problems out loud. And this, but then those people don't realize, it's like, but this strip's been going for 25 years at this point.
Yes.
It's not that it isn't, and it always was like that. It's these kind of children who are, people say, oh, they behave like adults, and it's like, that's not it. They're children behaving like children, but children behave like adults.
Yeah.
It's that kind of, it's not infantilizing. It's actually when you talk to kids, they're much more like this. They're much more kind of heart on their sleeve. They really do tell you everything because they're not really in that way that kids say the funniest things because they're unfiltered. They'll also say sometimes things that seem really moving or really like tragic or because they're just telling you what they're thinking.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you if they're upset about something and they'll say it in a way that's really open. And that's what it is. It's very open-hearted. And it's just people saying what they're thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And it's, he is so good at observing. And I think that's why so many of the female characters are so well-rounded and complex. Mm. You know, they are just as well-rounded as complex as the boys. They've got just as much agency as, I mean, there's, cause Lucy isn't the only girl. Often in cartoons you'll have like a bunch of well-rounded boys and a girl one, and it's not like that. There's Lucy, who's well-rounded and antagonistic, and there's Peppermint Patty, good grief. Yes. I mean, we're talking about how much we like a tenacious character and just her yearning. She is so sad and just so complicated, and I just feel for her so much. And who's the one who calls her sir?
What's her name? Marcy.
There's Marcy. Is it Sally? Charlie Brown's little sister. So there's all these female characters who are wonderfully well-rounded, and yeah, you really, really feel for them as much as you do any of the boys. And you know, you've got they've got running gags. They've got, you know, there's the Lucy's thing about the football, which continues to be an amazing analogy
for
trusting the same person over and over again. Is that, you know, the madness is when you do the same thing over and over and expect different results. It's kind of like that, but in terms of trusting someone who says, I definitely won't fuck you over this time. Okay. And you know they will. You know, and it's such a good, certainly at the moment, I suppose politics has always been like that, but politically, Lucy holding the football always feels like a really good analogy for a lot of the politics we've got.
She really is incredible. She's also not, unlike Peppermint Patty, who's got that sort of tomboyishness, Lucy is very much like, she's a girl. And she wants,
she's got her new dress.
She's got this thing where she's sort of she's very powerful. She's probably the most powerful one in the group, and she sort of exerts such a big influence on everyone else. And she is a very attractive character. She's not, for someone who can be bossy and mean, everyone is kind of, she's still such a very appealing character.
Yeah, I think she's canonically quite pretty because she's got that lovely black hair, and she's always like very well turned out in a nice blue dress, and she's got her bows, and you know, she's always very sort of neat and tidy and clean. So, I think canonically she is quite pretty.
I think she's set up to be the kind of opposite of Peppermint Patty, who's the sort of more tomboyish one. But they're kind of both, they've got similarities, but they're also completely opposites. They've got this. But both characters are kind of, they're really sort of well-rounded, but as is everyone. I mean, it does sort of feel that way. I mean, the ones that always seem a bit more two-dimensional are even people like Pigpen, who you go, just a kid that smells.
Your joke is you're just dirty. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the confidence, and it's certain the confidence is the thing where they're absolute opposites, because Peppermint Patty is not confident at all, and Lucy is so confident. And I think those extremes of confidence are what draws me to both of them. I think I really like a character who's really confident and tenacious, but I also really like a character who just thinks they're shit.
I'm exactly the same.
Yeah, but she does also have this softness, as you say, in Schroeder.
parties, he'd play something nice like April showers. I'm sure you could play something nice like April showers.
I think, it's the softness, and just not just for a boy, but for like an artistic boy. And that she'll listen to him playing. She'll just sit with him and listen to him playing piano. And he's obsessed with Beethoven, who's this great romantic figure. He's got all these aspirations to be this great romantic, in which I mean a great composer of romantic music and a creator of romantic era art and stuff. And yeah, he is very standoffish, which must be very, very, must be very, very appealing to a girl Oh, this really standoffish artistic guy who barely knows I exist. I want some of that. I can absolutely understand her crush.
Yeah, but we kind of also see him through her eyes, whereas he is, like, when from the outside, he is just very aloof and not very likeable. But because she likes him so much, you go, well, there must be more to him. Whereas just, you know, what we see of him is this sort of quite haughty character on a piano. I thought about that when you were saying, well, I was initially trying to think of cartoon characters. And initially you said, oh, you could kind of stretch it to comic characters.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, yeah, you know, I'm someone that likes comics, but I was thinking, well, that doesn't really work for me as people I find attractive in comics. Because I think of like sort of that kind of American comics world is all done by people that are different artists all the time. So there's always going to be different interpretations. Then when you think about something, you think, well, actually, those kind of newspaper strips are of, you know, they're very author driven. There's one look and one voice, and it's that. And then when as soon as you think of Peanuts, it's like, oh, well, of course, when I was a kid, I had a crush on Lucy. Of course it did. And I think you're right. It's that, but also Peppermint Patty in a way. And I think you're right. There's something where I'm both really attracted to very confident people and also people incredibly shy. I identify a lot with Charlie Brown. But more and more, I wonder whether how well Charlie Brown is realised and whether there's enough stuff that anyone who would at all consider themselves the even like a percentage a bit sensitive will always kind of go, oh, well, that's me. Yeah. I think there's sort of maybe Charlie Brown is less well drawn than Lucy or Peppermint Patty in a way. But I do. Charlie Brown is very much like, you go, oh yeah, that's me. That's me as a kid. It's sort of me as an adult. It's not. There's not that much difference.
I mean, I think so. There's a good quote from Charles Schulz who says that in a way he is also Lucy. So he said about Lucy, Lucy comes from that part of me that's capable of saying mean and sarcastic things, which is not a good trait to have. So Lucy gives me a good outlet. But each character has a weakness, and Lucy's weakness is Schroeder. I think that I think that kind of explains her popularity, that, you know, Lucy is that part of us where we can just, she voices like our frustrations, I think. And, you know, we all have a little mean voice inside of us, whether we let it out or not. Maybe she is that sort of grand idea of like a person who just is all that darker meaner side. And also, you know, he gave a character who represents his mean side a softness. So even our meanness can have softness and appreciation, I think, as well.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's why we like her, even though you could take against her, but there's still that, you know, she isn't infallible and she's got her own weaknesses. They're all, even then, there's a sort of humanity still that's like, I mean, she's incredibly human, but I think because of the Schroeder thing, there's that kind of, there's that bit of you where, yeah, that's when you become her, because you go, oh, I can see that.
Yeah.
I can be her. So that's it. We're all the characters, I suppose.
Yes.
That does make sense when it's just aspects of
one man's human nature.
Yeah.
As a bunch of children in the 50s suburbs. Well, I'm going to go from one brunette in a blue dress to another, because your second choice is the Stone Age reimagining of a 50s sitcom character. Like her best friend, she gets so much help with her housework from various prehistoric animals that you think she'd find more time to get some hobbies or possibly think about how she's punching way, way below her belt husband-wise. Her feet are bare, her adopted son is ridiculously strong, her dishwasher is a stegosaurus or something. It's the Flintstones' Betty Rubble.
Yeah, I think this is probably my most basic answer of them. I think this is my most basic. But I would say the reason she's on the list is because I think she is underappreciated. I mean, this is the whole point of this podcast.
Yeah.
But I think she is kind of underestimated at just how attractive she is. Because I think the joke has always been, and you touched on it there, is that what on earth is she doing with Barney Rubble? What on earth is she doing with it? Because I think it's that idea that it's when you see her, there's something about that kind of cartoon modern kind of design of that 50s and 60s.
Yeah, the mid-century modern design.
Yeah, and she is, to me, that is what that's telling me as the you know, marks on a paper is that what's being drawn there is an incredibly attractive woman.
Yes.
That's the signifier of it to me. And I feel like people talk about Betty as if she's like, oh yeah, you know, she's just and I mean, to be fair, that is one of the issues with the sitcom is that Betty and Wilma aren't terribly three-dimensional. They're there to go, oh Fred and oh Barney. Yeah. But I almost think that people seem to not understand. This is going to make me sound like a madman, but people don't seem to understand how attractive Betty is. You go, Betty is stunning.
Yeah,
Betty. That's like everything about that drawing is designed to make you go, "Oh my god, who's that?"
And she is really pretty,
and yet she is with Barney Rubble, who's this tiny kind of flubby man. And I think that's, to me, that's always the joke. It's like you almost go, and it is that thing where Barney's got like, but what Barney has is he's got a slight coolness about him, or he doesn't care as much as Fred does.
Yes.
So there's a slight, and that's slightly attractive. But I always think part of the joke is that Barney is with this incredibly beautiful woman, and that's always a joke that you're meant to always at some point be going, how has this happened?
It even became a thing on Clueless, Clueless, the 1994 movie. It created the term a Betty,
yes,
who is a very attractive girl or woman who's romantically involved with boy or man who's the Barney, who's much less physically attractive than she is. But right, I think that generally there's quite slim pickings in Bedrock, in the Stone Age in general, because she is not the only gorgeous woman with this with this rectangle of a man. Because she's best friends with Wilma, who's another absolute stone cold hottie, and she's with Fred, and Fred's not just chubby; he's also a bully. You know, he's overbearing, he's arrogant, he's loud. I do not like Fred. I do really like Barney, because Barney's much sweeter. Yes. And whether they're also much more lovey-dovey than Fred and Wilma are. They always sort of they've got the pet names for each other, and They're obviously desperately in love with each other still after we don't know how many years. And I think that adds to the attractiveness. So clearly, whether there's slim pickings or not, and I say that there must be slim pickings out there for the cave women, because Fred is not a catch. I think the fact that she is not caring that she's with a little tiny square of a man just adds to her attractiveness, really.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I wonder if it actually retrospectively works quite poorly the other way around, where we're meant to, that is, we're almost seeing Barney through Betty's eyes, where we're meant to go, well, Barney's great because he must be because he's with Betty. Or there's, but yeah, Barney has a cool, he's cooler than Fred is.
He is.
A bit more, he's more chilled out. He's got a much more calm demeanor. But yeah, I think you're right. But I would say, I think you're right in that, and I'm glad we've gotten into this. I think Wilma is very attractive, but I think there's something, I think Betty is drawn to be almost like the archetypal kind of as, almost as pretty as a cartoon drawing in that style could
be. I mean, she is quite underwritten. And I was going on the fan wiki because there's a fan wiki for everything. I was going on the fan wiki and even the fan wiki is like, yeah, she's hella underwritten. And it, part of that is because the Flintstones is an animated reworking of The Honeymooners, which was a 1950s Jackie Gleason vehicle sitcom. And Betty's based on the Trixie Norton character, who again was very underwritten. Because it was mostly about Jackie Gleason's character and his best friend and his wife. And also the best friend had a wife, but she was not there so much. She was portrayed as quite bossy, though, Trixie Norton and a pool hustler. So that hasn't really been translated, this sort of toughness. She just became this very, very sweet, soft, gorgeous woman.
Well, in a way, I'm glad we've had this conversation because I feel like I felt, well, actually, I think what's actually you've proven is that I'm wrong, is that I felt that Betty was underappreciated. Whereas actually, I love the fact it's like, oh, yeah, I haven't seen Clueless in years. But when you've said that, it's like, oh, I do remember that now. So it does feel like, well, I'm glad there's an appreciation for the beauty of Betty Rubble. That I was hoping. Exactly. Good, I'm glad. I was thinking, no. I think she's often underserved or seen as something else. Like, no. Barney has done incredibly well for it. It's remarkable. It's remarkable that they've ended up together.
Yes, I mean, there's also the Bam Bam storyline, and the show made a big thing of the fact that Bam Bam's adopted.
Barney, will you please stop with the falling star stuff?
But we both wished, Betty. That's what gave it the double whammy, the zoom zoom.
Oh, Barney, that's not our baby. He belongs to someone. Here's a note in the basket. Please take good care of Bam Bam.
Bam Bam? That's an odd name.
He is an orphan and needs a good home and the peaceful surroundings of bedrock. Oh, Barney, we've got our very own baby.
And that he is just as adored as Fred and Wilma love Pebbles, their biological daughter. And I think that's, just thinking back on it, again, sort of when this was made, the kind of story that they were trying to create, again, of sort of mid-century Americana, but the joke is that suburban Americana is Stone Age now. It is sort of very sort of mid-century nuclear families living in suburbia. And the fact that in this like really traditional suburban sitcom, they've got a family with an adopted child who is absolutely adored, and they never mention that they're trying for a biological child. They're just like, this is our son, we found him, we've adopted him, we love him, and he's got superpowers. And then they just go with it, that a family unit doesn't just mean biological parents and biological children, and that fatherhood and motherhood, even in their imagining of the Stone Age, something that was created in the 60s, but parenthood does not necessarily mean just procreating. It's about nurture and not about just passing your genes and your name along. And that to me is like really appealing to the, like with what we were saying about Peanuts, it's this sort of mid-century American art that's made about suburbia and about their time is saying something that sort of goes against the idea we have now been told about what it was like back then.
Yeah, I think that it's important for the Flintstones. Cause I think when I was a kid, the Flintstones was a kid show. And yet it was this thing that in the States, it was a prime time show. It was very much like The Simpsons. It was broadcast in the evenings for adults to watch, and I'm sure, or a family audience. It was like, it very much was that sitcom. It was, whereas I think some of the other ones that came later, you kind of dialed down the idea of it, whereas The Flintstones is a sitcom.
It had like a laugh track, which was really confusing. Yes. Like, you did not animate this in front of a live studio audience.
And it's got an adult audience. And I think, isn't it, I don't know if this is an urban myth, isn't it the one they always say that it was the first show on TV that could have a couple sleeping in the same bed? But before that everything else was like, you can't have that. But The Flintstones was almost pioneering in that way, where I think it got away with it, and that idea that, oh, but it's a cartoon, I guess, so yeah, it must be fine.
I don't know whether that's an urban myth or not, but it seems to be around that mark, around the sort of the change between the 50s and the 60s. I mean, certainly they showed Wilma going through pregnancy. Yes. So they made it very, very open. These guys fuck. Yes. These guys fuck like you would not believe. And it made jokes about, you know, Barney and Betty being in like a physically loving relationship. So it didn't show married couples as being in this weird sort of Dick Van Dyke showy kind of almost sort of sexless relationship. It did show them, you know, having babies, and, you know, these guys screw. And it was open about that.
As well as it being the honeymooners, that the reference I always assumed from even when I was a kid was the bit at the end where you've got Fred punching on a locked door to get back in.
Yes.
Sharon Wilmer is Streetcar Named Desire. It's very much, yes, Marlon Brando screaming, yeah, Stella when he, yes, can't get in. It's that, yes, same. You have that thing where Fred in that way is kind of hyper masculine, and and there is this, I mean in that way, going back to, I mean, this is what the podcast is, as I've said twice, it's that thing where I guess that's another sort of thing where people find that attractive. There's an attractiveness to someone being hyper-masculine. But maybe we're reading too much into this, or maybe if we can't do it here, then where can we?
Listeners, make up your own minds. Don't write in. I don't care.
imagine the mailbag. Imagine what that, yes, would be like.
We have got, yeah, oh, you and your mid-century characters, I, yes, swear to God. So your third choice is another mid-century housewife and mother. Yes. But this one is a retired superhero. She's frustrated but flexible. She knows how to fly a friggin' fighter jet. She can kick your ass in the lobby while having an argument with her family in the kitchen. She has a massive ass. No, really, the guys at Pixar want you to make very clear that her arse is huge. It's Mrs. Incredible, a.k.a. Elastigirl, a.k.a. Helen Parr from The Incredibles.
Yes, very much so. And in theory, it could get larger. That's it. She had stretchy abilities.
Exactly.
But she never chooses to make it smaller, and why would she?
Why, indeed. She just looks at it in the mirror a lot, Pixar guys. What's all that about? Well, we know what all that's about because one of the Pixar girls is a creep.
Of course, I've forgotten. I love Helen Parr and I love The Incredibles. And I think, yeah, I was in love with her from within like 30 seconds. And that's partly, I think, is that ever since I was a kid, one of my biggest crushes is Holly Hunter.
Right.
Always has been.
Always has been.
Always as a kid, like, and it, to me it always felt weird. It's like that I didn't hear other kids talking about her, and it's like, no, have you not seen Broadcast News? They hadn't. but it's that there's something, I think, and it is her voice, but it, but there is something where it's very easy to project Holly Hunter onto Helen Parr.
Yes.
Even though, you know, they're not identical, but you can go, no, it is kind of her. It is kind, yeah, of her. And also there is that bit where it starts where, and also when it starts, you've got the kind of, when they've got their, they're both very young and glamorous, yeah, and they've got this. So already then she's like, you are meant to go, oh man,
yeah,
Helen Parr, yes, please.
Yeah.
But also everything about her, and when it's almost, when she's now that the mother, almost more so, you just go, oh God, she's so brilliant. I love her, yeah, so much. And I think I've projected so much onto, from Holly Hunter onto Helen, yeah, Parr, that it's almost, there's some sort of transference has happened where I'm now just in love with the cartoon character. And when you asked me to do this, a lot of it was, well, Helen Parr's the answer. Oh, I love two others. It's like, I've already made my choice. But yeah, very much so. And it's this, I don't know. I think that film is one of the best films of the 21st century.
It really is. I welled up during it because at the time, like there weren't really any, you know, there'd been X-Men, but there weren't really that many superhero films, not ones that were funny and not ones that were clever and sort of talked in that way about sort of, is it ethical to have superheroes and sort of the idea of, you know, superheroes who sort of having to live normal lives. And I know that had been covered a lot in like the comics and the graphic novels and so on, but at the time it hadn't really reached film, and that, you know, we've got an absolute saturation of that kind of movie now. But at the time it felt like such a clever way of talking about superheroes and the idea of what you'd do with if you had superpowers, which is something, you know, even then, you know, that's something you'd think about, oh, what kind of superpower would you have and what would you do with it and stuff like that. But it was a really clever and interesting way that they dealt with it. And it was so beautiful as well with the mid-century. I love a bit of mid-century modern, with that mid-century aesthetic to it. And just it's got this real downbeat sadness to it. And I think especially Helen just sort of carries this sadness to her, that, you know, that she's got the whole sort of, when she has her speech at the start, she goes, I don't think so. And then she's doing the thing that she said she'd never do. And she's sort of making the best of it. But you kind of feel like she's missed out on something big. And it's not Bob's fault. It's the fault of the, you know, them having to retire a lot of the supers.
It is, but you see it through his eyes and you take it for granted with her. He takes it for granted. And you see they're both going through the same thing. But it's almost that he can't see that. For him, it's a personal thing. And there's something being attacked in him, where what you don't see is she's going through exactly the same thing, but is also juggling all this other stuff and isn't allowed to have her story until sort of the midpoint, where you sort of realise that when she comes back, it's just, it's like much more.
It's amazing.
And they're all having these little kind of rebirths. It's a real, I mean, it is, it's all that. It did take so much. I mean, really, it's The Incredibles is the Fantastic Four film. When it's like, when people say, oh, they haven't done a proper one, and they go, well, they've done The Incredibles, which is basically the Fantastic Four. It's this family. And also, it feels like they've kind of nailed it. So they almost, I don't know how you could do one that's better. Because it is taking all those tropes from the Fantastic Four and they've sort of muddled all the powers up, but they're basically all still the same characters with the same powers.
Because Elastigirl has Mr. Fantastic's power. I guess Bob is more like the Thing. Is it the Thing?
Yes.
And then Jack's got Human Torch's power. And then, Violet's. Yeah, and Violet's got the Invisible Girl's power. Yeah. The moment in the film for me that was like defining, both for Helen and just for the film in general, is the bit where she's on the plane and she's panicking because the missiles are coming in and her children are on the plane.
At 20 miles south-southwest of your position, Angels 10 track east, disengage, over. Bye. You have to put a force field around the plane.
But you said we weren't supposed to use our power.
I know what I said. Listen to what I'm saying now. Disengage, repeat, disengage. Mayday, mayday! India Gulf 999 is buddy spiked! Abort, abort! There are children aboard, say again!
There are children aboard, and
go!
Put a field around us now!
I've never done one that big!
Violet, do it now! Abort, abort, abort! Abort, abort, abort!
And that's something that you'd not, again, with the way that superhero films had been up to that point, that's something you'd never seen before. You'd never seen a superhero panic and yes. just have that desperation in her voice, and to be aware of what it must be like to be a parent with your children in that peril that you've accidentally put them in, that you're the kind of mission that you'd normally be fine with is now so terrifying because your children are there and your children are in danger. And just that panic in her voice, and Violet not being able to put a force field around the plane, and her having to shout at her child, which she doesn't want to do, but it's just such a desperate situation. And then, you know, any plan that they did have to stop the missiles hitting fails, and they're just falling through the sky. That is such an amazing scene.
Yeah.
And it felt really groundbreaking at the time to have a superhero just fail in that way, and to be to be so stressed and so panicked, and not be like really super cool and have like a quip for everything.
And being this, and she's a mother, and that bit is a performance, which again goes back to Holly Hunter. It's that thing where you've got these actors in it that are real, like they're proper actors. Not to dismiss people that do voice acting, but you are getting a different quality when you get kind of actors of that caliber to just do a voice behind something. And it's that film. There's so many bits. I mean, one of the bits that always gets me is the bit which just Dash running through. When he first able to kind of tap into his speed, and you suddenly see him filmed in such a way. And also someone that grew up with superhero comics, I've never seen that stuff as well realised, certainly up until that point, as how those powers would look on screen and how they'd be translated. But yeah, I mean, I think that the other thing with Halle Berry is that she's a mother, so she's got this completely different energy in a superhero film. And again, a lot of it comes from the Fantastic Four, but it's so nice to see that stuff represented in a way that it's like it's all the best things that I like about all these different properties, almost sort of filtered through. It feels like a thing that's very personal. Everything about that film felt like it was very personal to me, as if someone's pulled things out of my brain and I'm just going, this? And it's just like every minute, kind of, yes, please. Yes, please. Yes, please. Who's in it? It's basically Holly Hunter. Oh, God.
Holy shit.
it's like so much. There's so much stuff that's my bag on the screen. And it's, like you say, and it was bringing in all this stuff that, I mean, and now it's probably, we are probably a bit more familiar with it. And not, I mean, not that stuff about those superheroes being bad. It's like stuff that's out of Watchmen. And it is this thing where, again, there is a sort of, you know, even within their marriage, it's like a sort of rebirth. And within that fact, everything is kind of like in Watchmen, there is a sort of, I mean, I wouldn't say it's sexual, but it isn't not sexual either. There's a real kind of, it's like they've got this kind of, they've got a renewal that happens during this marriage where he's bored.
Definitely.
And that's it. It's not, and that is that thing where you can get annoyed at him where it's always assumed that it's about him. And he assumes it's about him. And it's like, it's not just about you. It's about everyone.
Exactly. And these people are, well, certainly your wife is absolutely his equal in terms of superhero abilities, but also in terms of the family. And that's his journey. His journey is learning that and accepting that. And I think her journey is accepting her worth. That's not that her being a wife and mother has taken away from her worth, that she's still able to enjoy that as part of her identity, but that also, you know, she is a superhero. She does have superpowers, and to enjoy both of those and to be treated as an equal in both of those. I've got to say, it is really, really nice to see. I was thinking about this. So part of it is, if you follow me on Twitter, you'll know about this, my thing about hot dad characters. Look, I'm 42, I've got a type. But we get some hot mum representation. And I was trying to think about other middle-aged female superheroes, and I couldn't think of any.
Yeah. I guess it's that they don't want them to age, do they? I mean, that's something.
They killed off Natasha before she could become like a cool sort of 40-something action hero, but all of the, so they've got so many, they've got so many character, male characters who are 40, 50. So the only middle-aged action hero I could think of with sort of superpowers is Evelyn in Everything Everywhere All at Once. That's the only person I could, and that film came out last year, which is ridiculous.
No, it is interesting, isn't it? Because you've not even got characters who have been allowed to age, really, in the same way. You've not even had that. No, that is interesting. And it could perhaps only happen in a film that's animated in a way. It feels like maybe that is still a big taboo. But with Helen Parr as well, it's more that she's more powerful later as a mother. There's more consequence to what she does. Mm. You're a better superhero by your kind of how you progress as a human being.
Yes. Almost.
That's how it all kind of ties up. And that's what that feels like. She's almost better now. And at the end, it's that idea that they're a family and they're, and again, it's such a, I don't know, it's such a punch the air movie. They're always so pumped up when I watch it. And and it's that when you think back on it, there's so many reasons to do it. But yeah, she's a much more powerful hero than she was at the start by the end.
Yes.
So even as a mother, she's got more powerful. You know, she's got this whole thing. And she's this kind of matriarch who runs the whole family. And it's not Mr. Incredible. It's not at all. He isn't at any point he's not the leader, even though he might think he is. He never is at any point, really. And I think as it goes on, the sequel was kind of, it was all right. But it doesn't have have the same impact or anything. But
really,
I mean, that sequel kind of shows as well. It's kind of, it is her. She's the one. Yeah. She's the main character, really.
Yeah, it was a shame that they didn't really know what to, they'd worked out, the main character is Helen, and they were like, what do we do with her? We're not sure. We might do sort of disjointed sort of half retread of the first film, maybe, which was a real shame. It could have been, I left The Incredibles 2 going, well, that was a shame. Mm. Whereas I left the first Incredibles going, holy shit, that was so good. Oh, well. Disney and Pixar sequels, besides Toy Story 2, tend to be a little bit, that's a shame.
I suppose they didn't owe us anything. I'm happy with
Incredibles.
They didn't.
They'd already given us the perfect superhero film.
Yeah.
That is fair. Well, I shall leave this on one more question, which is that, I probably know the answer to this already. If you could, if you could make one of your three choices a flesh and blood human, who would you bring into the real world and would you try to romantically pursue them?
I would bring Helen Parr back, and I would, and she probably would just be Holly Hunter then.
Yeah.
Although I'd feel terrible about breaking up the family. I mean, I would genuinely be the villain of the third Incredibles.
You'd be the villain of the Incredibles 3.
Do you know what? I think I'd then have a Lucy Van Pelt moment, and I'd make her more of a, she could exist in the world, but I might just, it might be very unrequited. I'll just let her get on with her life. As I have done with the real Holly Hunter,
that's fair. Oh well, on that bombshell where you make a second Holly Hunter in the world.
Yeah, that's fine. It's always good to have more than one.
Exactly, a spare Holly Hunter. Are there any projects coming up that you'd like to talk about?
I'm working on a new, or possibly two new, podcasts with Nick Helm, but we haven't officially announced it yet, so I won't say what it's called, but that will be coming out at some point, so you can keep an eye on that.
Yeah, they can follow you on your socials.
Yes.
What's your socials?
I'm Nat Metcalf on Twitter, and I'm Nat Metcalf Comedy on Instagram and Facebook.
Brilliant.
Huge thanks to Nat Metcalf. For more credits and details, see @curiously_drawn on Twitter.